Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. Remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Today, let us make them remember. We are not
Declare your independence from me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, IA, from the BEA beautiful studios of Freedoms of the Nest, freedomsphoenix.com. Now, what we're going to do today, let me give you the lineup, and then we'll get right to our first guest. First, we're going to have Lenny Charles. Now, Lenny Charles has, the banking system has affected a lot of people. Now, you know, it's money is always half of every transaction. You know, you go back and forth, who benefits, who gets the goodies. Well, this has had an impact on the progressive media as well. And what's interesting to me is we're going to talk to Lenny. He was introduced to us by Eileen Proctor, is one of our suppliers of some great guests. And she asked, she called and asked that we talk to Lenny. She thought we'd be interested in this. And I'm going to go ahead and we'll get to him in a little bit. Let me tell you what it's about. Here you have a building in New York City, that a supporter says, hey, you know, while I'm doing renovation or building, doing whatever, we'll get loans and take care of. You guys can have this area and you produce your media and go save the world. Okay? So they're out there doing that very thing. Well, what happened all of a sudden, as they had their philosophical discussions and the progressiveness that they need of the government to fix and do and whatever, around them, the financial storm is going on. Do they understand what was happening? Did they see the connection between that and what they were advocating? Well, we're going to find out. So as it started, the financial crisis hits and the walls start tumbling down around them, they started to peek their head up and go, hey, well, I said, what? And they started checking out stuff. Well, they start finding out things. And we're going to see how it affected their perspective on the world, what they thought the role of government should be, the banking system. So we're going to learn from Lenny his experience and how this building made, you know, available to them to be able to advocate for whatever it was that the owner was supportive of and what they were able to accomplish, and how now the reality of the world comes crashing down on them. What did they learn? Well, we're going to find out in just a little bit. Then we have Eric Voorhees. The topic is going to be BitInstant.com, B-I-T-Instant.com. It's all about Bitcoins. Now, there's Bitcoins is going to, the concept itself of being able to extricate yourself using the internet and digital money, is that a viable alternative? Now, there is a, you know, a lot of opinions on this, both, you know, good and bad, but I'll tell you. I like having silver in my hand, but if you're going to be able to do, you know, little ones and zeros and electrons and create money and send and do, well, what if you got some Uber geeks that know how to do it, limit the capacity of the creation of the money? It has a finite amount that it can be, and you mine it by serving the industry, by having servers that process this information, and that creates the Bitcoins. You know, so we're going to get it explained to us because I still don't understand, even after we did a magazine entirely on this type of stuff. And it was last month. Okay. So we're going to go ahead and understand this, because what has happened from around the world, people that do understand it, that are of that mindset, that are the computer scientists, that are the Uber geeks, are going, ding, oh, I get it, enthusiastically lapping their arms and legs around this thing. And it came to the attention of the bad guys enough that we have Mr. Schumer in Washington, D.C., actually mentioning Bitcoin, and we got to do something to stop them. Wow. If they got their boy Schumer out there saying, well, then there must be something, So we're going to find out from Eric. Then in the last hour, Jeff Neen, Convoy of Hope, feeding, helping people with no government. Now, this was Dr. Ron Paul did his Texas Straight Talk yesterday. He does every Monday, highlighting Convoy of Hope. Now, I've seen different organizations similar to this around in our times and, you know, travels and so on. We've had a lot of people that do a lot of things for life. But if Dr. Paul went by the seat and said, you know what, you want to see a private, no government, take care of people, get the heck out of the way, Convoy of Hope. So we're going to be talking to them about that. But first, let me go ahead and introduce you to Lenny Charles and say hello, Lenny.
Hello. How are you?
Good morning. I'm more than wonderful. Thank you. I want to let's start off by understanding what it is that your attention to how the media, well, I don't think you're advocating that they're targeting you in specific, but you were motivated to go find out what the heck was going on with the banking system as it finally started to affect what you were doing. Let's go ahead and talk about the importance of this building to your effort and how you got interested in what's been going on with the banks.
Well, we're in the alternative media. And the alternative media, I imagine that once you make the same case about your show, the alternative media is going to present to you stories you might not want to hear, but the rest of the world is living these stories. A lot of it's international news. A lot of it's government fraud. It is. We've always looked at our organization as a healthy merger of the far left and the far right. I don't mean far right in a bad way. I mean people like Dr. Ron Paul. We actually had him in our studio once. We were very happy to associate ourselves with those people that are trying to protect rights and liberties and human dignity. And at the same time, there are a lot of people on the progressive side that have a good bit of common sense. Our backbone was a moral backbone, like Dr. Ron Paul advocates. It's the golden rule in a way. It's not particularly religious, it's particularly what the human should do to keep themselves alive, let's say. And knowing that you don't bomb other people's children and get a good result, we want to protect our own and protect theirs too. So we came out of alternative news with a not necessarily progressive or a libertarian background, but a combination of what makes sense to everyone. Knowing that, we went out and did a whole lot of reporting. INN World Report was the evening news on a Dish Network station called Free Speech TV for quite a few years, 6 or 7 years. We've done thousands of stories for them. We were a companion show for a show called Democracy Now!, which is extremely popular and well-funded. We were never well-funded. We didn't use a fundraising model, a little bit of fundraising and grants, but very little. Instead, we supported ourselves by using the building to raise money and keep up the salary and keep up the broadcast, the expenses of the broadcast. We would, the bottom three floors of this incredibly valuable six-story loft building in Tribeca, one of the most expensive neighborhoods in the world, was essentially supporting INN, allowing us to do the kind of reporting that we believe people needed to hear. So we'd rent it out for TV shoots, for community gatherings like the community center, for dances, parties, art shows, music shows, all kinds of stuff. And the income from that would be used to keep INN on the air and keep telling the story as best as we could. Well, one of our board members, Guy Morris of Colorado, and also a very close friend of mine for many years, said, look, you know, we're doing a renovation on the building. We're going to give you a good lease, a sweetheart lease, 20-year lease, that you can keep doing the work.
Okay, let's go ahead and stop right there, because here's where we get started. They went and got a loan. A loan. Real estate prices always going to go up. We'll get us a loan. And then their trouble started, I am sure. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence with Lenny Charles, and we're just getting started. Yeah, we're going to find out how the banks are affecting everybody. And then we're going to get into, you know, where it's going. We'll be right back.
This is Charles Goyette, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Dollar Meltdown, so you can learn how to protect yourself and your family. Now, you can audit the Fed. You can end the Fed. But why not start by ignoring the Fed? Visit DonttreadOnMeme.com. That's Don't Tread on M-E-M-E, Fashioning the Silver Economy. A meme, a contagious idea that spreads within a culture, a spontaneous order. Nowhere is this more evident than in one's free choice in that most marketable of commodities, money. Let us Austrians use wallet voting. Don't Tread on Meme, the leading craftsman of silver dime trading cards, as well as some offbeat liberty-themed apparel. Follow the history of the dime card outreach at onceuponadime.info and get a silver calculator app at whatisthiscoinworth.info. Boycott an empire of theft. Build a society of consent. Don't Tread on Meme. Rhodes, it's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
No roads. Hey, welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Let me tell you what I'm looking at. I'm looking at silver. It's at 3182, but I have not seen, I can't remember, like, let me think, ever seeing what's happened on the market with silver. It is up, down, up, down, up, down. I mean, it's like every second, it's like it's being driven down, and it's punching up, driving it down, punching it up. I mean, it is oscillating like crazy. There is a war going on, man, in finances right now. Right now. We don't have time to talk about it today, but I'll give you just a 30-second here before we get back to Lenny. There was a time in the late 80s, it was like 88, 89, you know, we had Motivity Auto Detailing, a business that we had, along with Motivity Services and Laundry and all that stuff, one of the first businesses that I started. And I'll tell you, there was a home that some cardiac doctors, you know, some heart doctors, had set up some computer Uber kids with their computers in a home, gave them nice Porsches that we would detail and stuff all the time. And they had computers. I mean, here's some computer geeks out of college, and they said, you know what, we'd be doing some computer trading. And they were making money on the delay, you know, the kind of stuff that's going on, Saks does now all over anyway. Well, there was a beginning of that, and it was some young kids out in Scottsdale that were there doing it for some heart doctors. And they came in, they showed me this right here, and it was in it was some tennis shoe thing, and there's different things. You know, they showed, oh, this is where, right? Oh, and the SEC's going to get these guys, and oh, and this is, oh, yeah, but we're going to make some money in the process. And I remember this. I saw this is manipulation big time. So you're going to start hearing news about silver. You know, I can just see it. See it. And I don't know nothing. Nothing. Except that Jim Cramer is so full of crap, his ears stink. Okay. So Lenny Charles, let's go ahead and get back to him and the building. Now, here you have the owner of the building, real estate's doing well, and he's like, you know what, we can make some more money. We can go ahead and build some condos, we can get it finished out on here, lease out some more, and then your financial future will be secure, so we're going to go talk to the bank. Is that what happened?
Well, kind of like what happened, but let me say that for any of you, now you're in Phoenix, and I envy you for being in Phoenix, you know. A lot of INN's viewers were in Phoenix. We used to get a lot of correspondence from there, and I know a lot of people would watch us on Dish Network because it's a popular television medium down there. But in New York City, in the entire New York area, real estate and development is a blood sport. And these people aren't worried about government control because they don't care. They have enough money. In other words, if you're, they know, especially with the lenders, they have the high position with the government, that they're always going to win at the end of the day, which is where we've come to. And hopefully I'll explain how we got there. These people will ignore laws, they'll bend laws, they'll do whatever they have to do, and if there's enough money, the laws need not apply, as we've seen in so many other cases in our reporting over the years. But the idea of the building always was, the building is a six-story loft building built in the late 1800s. And in this neighborhood, the lofts are converted to what's known as luxury lofts. They put in new floors, walls, plumbing, double windows, high-end appliances. They make them big open spaces, and the banker types that are on Wall Street a few blocks away take their bonuses and buy the darn things. and they buy them for about $1,300 to $1,500 per square foot. So a condo here could, there's not a condo in town that's going to go for under $2 million in this neighborhood, and many of them go for quite a bit more. So this was a way to go ahead and take a warehouse building we paid $3 million for and turn it into a $15 or $20 million investment in return, and still have the bottom floors for our passion, which was telling news and informing people and also doing some cultural and music events and community events. This wasn't supposed to be a big money maker, but in a way it was the fruit of our labor. It was a way that we could do something we felt okay about. It would be a not-for-profit, but it would do all right. It would do okay, and the sale of the condos would be able to support the organization, support the new...
No, I have complete understanding. We're speculating. Okay, go ahead.
Well, you call speculating the money where we consider it a chance to pay for doing some good and for working with people.
No, I understand. You know, we're going to take advantage of this opportunity and the finances, as we understand it, to make some money so we can continue doing what we're doing. But what happened?
Well, it was a series of loans. They weren't perfect loans. It was originally a bank loan, and the construction took longer, so we took out a second loan and a third loan. Trying to get the construction done. There's always delays, City of New York, building department, codes, laws, regulations, et cetera, et cetera. So in 2000, government, some good, some bad. Let's just say government and leave it at that, okay? It certainly complicated things. And in 2007, a group came to us, wanted to make us a loan. We were about 70, a little over 70% completed with the conversion. And... this group comes to us through a loan broker, and it's called Wex Trust Capital. Okay, it's a private lender. They give us a commitment letter to loan us. We needed about $9 million, but they were going to pay themselves considerably more points, interest reserve. So it's going to be a little over an $11 million loan. They said, we're going to bring in a partner bank, and that's how we're going to do it. So they go out and they find a partner bank, Broadway Bank. Important to know three names if the story is to be followed. One is Wex Trust, also known as Wexford. The other is Broadway Bank. And the third is MB Financial. Each one of them has a story. Wex Trust loaned us the money. They never had all the money at the closing, and we figured, oh, well, that's okay. And they partnered with Broadway Bank. So Broadway Bank loaned us about $8 million. Wex Trust loaned us about $1 million, approximately, and then the rest they were just used to paying themselves. And supposedly we were going to have enough money to finish the project. Well, they loaned us the money in 2007 in September. And here comes December, and here's a contractor's draw. A contractor did a bunch of work. He wanted to be paid, and they said, we're not going to pay you. And they didn't give us a legal reason. They said, you've got to do something, but there wasn't anything in the contract saying we had to do it before this poor guy got paid. And so anyway, we weren't real good about that. So the short story is, in the period of this nine-month loan to finish the building, they didn't fund, or they funded, they certainly didn't fund, and the contractor walked off the job, and the project wasn't done. And at the end of the day, the partner bank says, okay, you know, your loan's done, you didn't finish your project, it's all your fault, even though they didn't fund the money to finish it, and we'd like all our money back, our story. Well, but you understood, and it was within the context of our agreement that we were going to finish the condos, sell the condos, and pay your money back. You didn't give us the money. We couldn't finish the
condo. But there was a provision in there that somewhere in some place on some line on some paper that said that you were supposed to do something that you didn't do. What was it?
No, there wasn't any provision like that said that. It wasn't. It was just a bank executive saying, we're not going to fund until you do this, but there was no written.
Until you do what? What were they wanting you to do?
They wanted us to, well, it was something very simple, complete the condo plan. And at the time, the condo plan was in process, but it was lawyers take their time, and we hadn't completed it yet. But the consequence of that was that they did not fund until it was complete, and it took another month to complete. It was on schedule. But the result of that was the contractor walked off the job, and they couldn't complete the contract. Well, there was nothing in our agreement with the bank that said that had to be done as a condition of them funding the construction. So that's how we got into this mess.
Okay, so then we're on the break. You know, they're going to push the button on us, and we're going to find out.
Tip of the iceberg.
Okay, we're going to get to the base of it really fast when we get back here on Declare Your Independence with Lane Charles in just a little bit.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800.
Yep. I knew there was something going on with Silver. I'm checking. I'm going, where's the news? Nothing. I'm going, you know, God, well, there's something going. Yep. It's coming back from the long holiday out of Europe. You know, I guess they have Monday off and so on. And it's like, oh, I got to buy. Oh, I got to sell. Oh, I got to buy. Oh, I got to sell. And who's selling? It looks like it's, you know, big bad boys are trying to drive it down while everybody and their grandma is trying to buy it. So it's going up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. If they weren't doing the plunge protection team crap, you know, and trying to keep silver down, it would be exploding right now. It's trying to. This is going to break a lot of people. I don't know what they're, you know, it reminds me of Renee's saying. She goes, we had signs, the Fed did it. The Fed did it. And they had a dollar sign with an arrow going down. The Fed did it. Did what? She goes, they printed money and bought gold with it. What, you thought it was more complicated than that? I see it happening right now. Oh, okay. I'm just making a prediction, okay? Silver. There is something funky going on with silver, and there's nothing in the news. You can just see kind of the, you know, hear the rumbling and see the lightning on the horizon, all right? I'm just because I see it, which means, what am I doing? I'm going to be buying me more silver, you know, because I think if I'm going to be doing a bunch of this dime stuff and everything, I need more silver right now. Right now, right now, right now. I'm calling Tim saying, Donna, remind me to get off the show. Call Tim, get more silver. Say hello, because I see it coming. Here we go. All right, so now we're back with Lenny Charles. They have a building worth millions of dollars. They get a loan. They got the banks in there. They're doing, and they're saying, oh, well, we're not paying because fill in the blank reason. But there was a real reason why they weren't paying. Lenny, how come they weren't paying?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. The real reason they didn't pay is because it was a giant Ponzi scheme, and the guys that made the loan are now in jail for the next 30 years. So there really was a reason behind this, and that's one of the banks. The other two banks have an equally sorted story. And I'll try to get to the point as best I can. Okay, Wexstrass Capital had been running a giant Ponzi scheme, taking investors' money and basically just paying themselves. They were starting a new bank account every day. They were taking on partner banks like they had in our case. And then they were taking these loans that they were administering and just selling them off. The entire operation was simply living off of swapping these loans, trading these loans, making new loans, taking the commissions, managing the loans, making payroll, and then doing the next one. All their funds were completely commingled. One of their partners had just gotten out of jail a couple of years earlier for bank fraud. Well, they were partnering with a major lending institution, Broadway Bank of Chicago. Okay, so Wextrust, these guys, they didn't loan us the money. They didn't have the money. It's just that simple. One of the partners was wearing a wire on the other two partners. He was already working for the SEC. September, our loan was made, almost a year after our loan was made, the SEC comes in, raids their offices, and locks down all their books. Accounting firm went over all their books. They never had the money. They had been insolvent for years before we ever heard their name. Okay, so what? They gave you the money, didn't they? Well, they did, but then they withheld the part of it that was necessary to complete the project. What happens? Is this a simple loan to own? Is this simply good business or predatory banking, which is considered good business in America? Well, maybe it is, and that's what we're trying to find out. The tale with the other bank is even crazier. After the loan went bad, we went to the other bank, Broadway Bank of Chicago, and said, look, let's make a deal. Everything went bad. Let's restructure the loan. Let's get out of this mess. They refused to do so. They wanted the building, or they wanted a lot of money being paid in interest, and that money would have been $100,000 a month. I'm trying to remember the exact number. $105,000 a month in interest with the building not producing any income. All right, we were already pretty stretched out. But who is Broadway Bank of Chicago? Does the name Giannoulis ring a bell? Well, the name Barack Obama rings a bell. We certainly know that. Alexei Giannoulis was one of the brothers that managed the bank. He was the former bank manager of Broadway Bank. Well, under the presidency, I guess it was, of Alexei Giannoulis, they had made loans to characters like Tony Rezko and a few others. They were also doing a lot of really illegal banking procedures like brokered deposits and out-of-town loans and loans without going through the diligence of finding out who their loan partners were. Broadway Bank should have known that Wex Trust was a giant Ponzi scheme. They didn't care. They considered their loan perfect anyway. This was a joint venture between a legitimate institution and a small lending institution, which was a complete Ponzi scheme. It was run and it was managed by the guys who were in jail. Well, okay, so Broadway Bank figures, well, tough titties. So what? Okay, we want our money and we want it now. We want our $8 million plus interest, or we're going to begin foreclosing, which is exactly what they did. Okay, well, they begin foreclosing. Pretty soon, the FDIC is looking at Broadway Bank. Okay, the younger brother was running the bank. The older brother was running for Barack Obama's Senate seat. He ended up losing that race in Illinois to a man named Kirk right now, who I understand is in the Senate, who had replaced Barack Obama in his seat. So here's this bank being now looked at by the FDIC. The family decides to jettison the bank. They come up to an agreement with the FDIC to close down the bank and put it in receivership and sell it off to another bank. Well, that bank is MB Financial of Chicago. Okay, MB Financial is a large lending institution, fairly large national bank, trying to get bought up by Citi or Chase. They want to go ahead and make their money that way. What does MB Financial do? MB Financial has a history with Guy Morris's family. His grandfather started the bank. But these people don't care. They eat their own. So anyway, we go to them. We go like, hey, guys, you know, the family's got some money in the bank. This deal went sour. Let's make a deal and settle. They won't even respond to court. They won't even respond to letters to the board, letters to the president, who was a family friend. They're simply going, we want all the money, and they hire a very high-powered law firm to go ahead and continue with the foreclosure based on fraudulent paper. They're trying to use the bankruptcy court right now. We had to file for Chapter 11 because they were attacking so hard. They were going for a summary foreclosure without any of these facts coming forward. There were so many facts, like when we all talk about mortgage fraud and how mortgages are not transferred correctly, and they're using mirrors, and they're using robo-signing, and they're using backdating, and they're using bad notaries. We've got all of that. When MB Financial assumed the note from Broadway, a fraudulent note that was created in fraud, all that comes into it, too. So there's no clear chain of title. So we've got a building with no clear chain of title. They withheld construction funds, caused damages, and the whole thing was created by a fraudulent bank. And we're sitting here going, you know, we don't know what to do. You know, this is now in the bankruptcy court is an equity court. It's not exactly a court of justice. The debtor, in our case, 56 Walker and Guy Morris, are the last in the food chain to get paid. Their job is to pay the creditors. So when we went into bankruptcy, everybody we owed money to, from lawyers to contractors to architects, took whatever money they thought they were owed and doubled it and tripled it and put up all these incredible liens on the building. So the court looks at these liens and says, well, until you prove them not accurate, your debt service in the building is going to be pretty close to $15, $16 million, including what the bank claims to be real. The only way that court can see our debt is like that. So what we're doing is we're taking the victim. There's no way. We had a meeting with the SEC when they closed down Wex Trust. The SEC, in correspondence, has called Guy Morris in the building a victim of the Wex Trust Ponzi scheme. We are a victim, according to the government, if you like to believe the government. I know you don't. But the SEC has called us a victim. Okay, it has no bearing in this court. This court has one job. We looked at it as a court of last resort, trying to finally get justice for a fraudulent loan that was turned against us. Own to own is the way that we looked at it. Made by a bunch of fraudsters who are now in jail.
So is that kind of where you're at now?
We're in bankruptcy court. They finally, just 2 weeks ago, appointed a Chapter 11 trustee who's pretty nice people, surprisingly. At least they're trying to figure out what's going on. But the only structure here is to punish the victim. The only thing the court can do, because we can't keep the building. They want to auction the building to pay the creditors. And then if the creditors prove to be false, then they don't get their money. But we don't get the money.
Okay.
At least we don't think we get the money.
When we come back, I have some thought. I know there's a lot of people out there listening that are involved in this on a smaller scale or even a larger scale. And I know what they're screaming. Tell them about this. Tell them about that. Tell what's the next thing they need to do is. And we'll talk about that when we come back here on Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, and just a little bit.
Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what the readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com get every day. FreedomsPhoenix.com, constantly providing the information, the real news about government policies, and the real relationship we all have with the coercive government. The real condition of the economy, innovations in technology, breakthroughs in energy, health, and computer science. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media. The corporate media, nothing more than distributors of government propaganda. But now there's an alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com. Constant news updates on the issues that affect your life in the most important ways. With liberty and property under constant attack, FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda, and it encourages the participation of its readers. Go to FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com. The revolution between the ears has already happened. Freedom is the answer. What's the question?
I want to break free.
You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
I want to break free. I want to break free from your life.
Yeah, let's break free with a little bit of information. So this is an interesting little walkthrough because, I mean, this is representative of like 15 gazillion other stories like this. But, you know, now we're getting to the point to where let's go ahead. Lenny, I got you there.
Yeah, you got me.
Okay, now let me give you an Ellen Wood version of what this has happened a lot here in Arizona. I mean, across the country. Same. Here's a story all the time. But what has happened is some people have been proactive in this and saying, you know who owns this? I do. I'm sitting right here until somebody can say they don't, but you have to file suit. You have to go out and say, produce the note, produce the paper. What gives you the, you know, over me? I mean, show me what you get, and they can't. Now, there was a provision in the law on these loans that if they had fraudulent loans from the beginning, it voided the entire thing. But, you know, it went up to the Ninth Circuit, and they go, well, it says that, but it wouldn't be prudent at this juncture for us to enforce that part of the law. And then it goes back and forth, and ouch, quit it. And I don't know what the district they're covering in New York would be. But you are so far down the road now, and you're so far deep into this, I'm not sure a proactive stance like that would have an effect. But there are two things. One, you know, if you do it through attorneys, it's going to cost you a gazillion dollars. Two, you have to have standing as the owner. There has to be someone there that's willing to do this. And then you got, you know, 15 gazillion paralegals willing to work for, you know, bread and a cot. I mean, you never know. But the thing is that how far you're far enough down the road here that is anybody occupying the building now?
I'm sitting in it right now.
Okay, so there is.
INN is still here. The TV studio is still here. The radio studio is here, and the condos are still here.
So what is the...
We have possession of the building, even with the Chapter 11 trustee.
Okay, now who is the... has standing as the owner or the person that took out the loan? Where are they?
They're in Colorado. Guy Morris.
Okay, and his inclination to do what is what? I mean, he's...
We've already spent over $250,000 on lawyers. This is not... We're not sitting here with shotguns in front of the building, although it's a pleasant thought. We've done everything we can legally. We've got, there were so many people that believe in our case and believe that we were seriously wronged here that they've been working for pennies. Yes, there is a small team of paralegals. The National Lawyers Guild has come forward. A lot of the groups from Occupy Wall Street have come forward to support us. This is not, there is plenty of legal standing. We have filed federal suits against the bank.
Okay, now let me ask you one question. I just need to know one thing. Has there been a proactive lawsuit, a case number, any kind of filing on your part?
Absolutely. Many. Several. Not only counterclaims in the original state court, we filed in federal court against the bank and its directors, done everything we can. This is New York. This is a banking state. It's for the banks, by the banks, and the political contributions come from the banks.
Okay.
We're dealing in a New York reality. Remember, money is your god, then human sacrifice is considered a very high form of praise around here. Human lives are not in question here. They're expendable.
So there has been money. A ruling at some point that
there's never been a ruling. There were simply pleadings and pleadings and discovery and pleadings. at the end of the day, nobody seems.
How many government numbers do you have? I tell you what you got. When you got a government number, it says case number CV blah 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 blah. You know, and then you got another number, another. How many numbers do you have? You have how many cases?
At least three or four that have been through. A minimum of three or four cases, including federal court, including bankruptcy court.
Okay, so that's why you're on the media campaign now with us, is that we're bringing attention to the fact that these guys, it's what? What are you hoping
to share? It's their world. They're going to win. It's their world. We're fighting as hard as we can. We borrowed every penny we can to fight this. Fraud is fraud. And then we had somebody tell us as recent as yesterday, well, yes, well, maybe, but they gave you the money. They gave us the money. Then they withheld the money. They never had the money to give us all the money. It's fraud, and then they didn't transfer the documents correctly. There have been so many court rulings, as you guys know, across the country. Robo-signing is illegal. Backdating is illegal. Your notary's got to be straight. There's got to be a clear chain of title. This is not important to these people. These people are simply, they gave you the money, you got to pay them back the money, all the money. If you have damages, that's great. Long after we auction off your building, you can go to another court somewhere in the future and maybe get some money back. In the meantime, I'm selling TV equipment on the street corner. This is not right. There's no way in any way you read these papers, even if you're a banker and you're reading these papers, you're going to chuckle to yourself because the system is working for you. There's no way anybody could say that the victim isn't being punished here. And I'm not whining. This is like you read this stuff and you go like, I can't even believe this is happening.
Well,
unless you really understand how money works and how politics work.
We get it. I'm just hoping from a progressive perspective, you know, you're looking at, there should have been, what happened? There should have been to stop this. Is there another law?
Right now there's an FDIC investigation into the interaction of, into everything Broadway Bank did. That was the one that started the foreclosure, and their interaction with MB Financial. There's a lot of really sleazy deals between these two.
Yeah, and they're going to find, yeah, you're bad, and the scapegoat goes and slap them on the wrist, and you can't, and they go out of business.
And we're out in the street. We're in the street. We still remain the victim.
So how did this happen?
How did what happen?
No, I mean, you know, what would you have done to make it where this didn't happen? This wasn't the result. What's the lesson learned from all this?
The lesson learned is it's more of a reality check. Other things almost couldn't have happened. When you deal with fraudsters, you're going to get burned. How else can you get out of something like this?
Then what is
the proper role?
Nothing
we could have done.
The proper role of government is to, you know, prosecute force and fraud. If they're doing fraud, you go after them. There's punitive. You quit it. You can't do. People are damaged.
Once you're in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, there is no structure for justice. There may be. We've got a good judge, very smart, and he's very inquisitive. But within his court, his job is to make sure the creditors are paid. Okay, well, who are the creditors? Which claims are legitimate? And these are all questions to be determined, including the bank. Is this a legitimate claim? Does it go from a secured to an unsecured claim? Well, even if it's unsecured, there's money. And then there's counterclaims. You've got damages against them, but these are not ruled on at the same time. So their remedy is to liquidate the asset and pay the legitimate creditors. Unfortunately, the word here is liquidate the asset. There's no way we can save our home or the home of INN. Okay, there's no structure to save the effort. And the last person to get paid is Guy Morris, who put in probably $3 or $4 million of his own money, the last $3 or $4 million I might mention, of his own money to try to make this a success. We did everything we could to try to make this a success story. We didn't accuse him of anything. Everything I've told you didn't come from my mouth. It came from the SEC and the FDIC. I'm just trying to regurgitate it.
No, I understand. We have an understanding of this. Happens a lot. I'm just trying to find what were the mistakes that were made in the beginning. You know, it was, kind of on the edge loan. We didn't really have, you know, it secured enough. Did you make a mistake from the beginning in getting involved with these guys?
Secured enough. The equity in the appraisals held the loan. It was a hard money loan. I mean, at the time, banks were getting very squeamish about loaning construction money. They want hard assets. They wanted established places they would loan on, and they wanted your income. Not just the equity of what you were doing, but they wanted your income also to back that up. They wanted heavy guarantees and long time periods to to vet out who you were before they would give you a legitimate, you know, at the time it was a 5 or 6% bank loan. Now it's less. We had to go outside that world into the hard money world, but the hard money world in this case pulled in a legitimate bank, an out-of-state bank. Well, they're all a bunch of gangsters as far as we could tell, and it's coming out through all the investigations. So we ended up falling in with a bunch of gangsters because the banks wouldn't, you know, wouldn't give us a straight loan. We had to go outside to finish the project to be able to pay back the loans.
Well, in the minute or two that we got left here, I'm hoping there's something you can share with the audience of what your awareness has been, what you came away from this. Well, we got about 60 seconds. Go ahead. Just, you know, help us out. What did you learn from all
of this? Well, I hate to say it. I've been, you know, because we're both in the news business here, I hate to say it. I've been a cynic back since election 2000 and before that in the Clinton years with Waco and everything else. I've always been a terrible cynic. And I hate to say I was right. I'm saying I'm right. We're getting slapped in the face from it, and we're about to lose everything we've got. So we learned our lesson based on everything that we supposed was true, and it came true. So we need some change out there in the world, and hopefully we'll both be a part of making that change.
Well, I'm glad that you shared with us this, and hopefully the awareness is that, I mean, if you're going to have a government, it's there to protect your rights, you know, the justice, right and wrong, and bad guys get punished, and good guys don't get damaged, and they get, you know, compensation. And it seems like the whole world is upside down.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Today, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
I want to know all about Bitcoin. I want to know because I don't understand, even though we've written a bunch of articles and had it in the magazine, people telling me and everybody's all enthusiastic about it, I still don't know. And who's going to tell us? Eric Voorhees. Eric, is that how you say your name, Voorhees?
Yeah, you actually got it right. Very good.
Ah, yeah, see, I got skills. Okay, this is the deal. I'm going to ask a bunch of questions because it looks like you may have the answers, damn it. Okay, here we go. Now, there was an article that you sent by Joshua Davis. Is it Davis? Davis. And the cryptocurrency. Now, tell me why you sent me this, before we even get anywhere else, why you sent me this particular article. And it's a lengthy article, and it was published where?
That was the one in the New Yorker, correct?
It looks like it, yeah.
Yeah.
So who's doing this? Who's Joshua Davis? Why is it in the New Yorker? And can I rip off this article?
he's a reporter for that magazine.
Okay.
But I sent that one to you because it was one of the most well researched. A lot of people who are writing these articles will just skim stuff on the internet for 10 minutes, but that guy actually went into some investigation of the entire phenomenon. So
okay. Now this is what I want to say right now. I want to get a commitment from you. This Friday is the publication of this next month's e-zine, Freedom's Phoenix Digital Magazine. I don't know if you've ever seen it or heard about it, but let me tell you. I need this information into it. Last month, we did an entire issue on cryptocurrency, on piracy, internet, everything. And I need someone from the inside to give me a detailed copy of this guy's whatever, I need this information in the magazine. Are you the guy?
I'm the guy, absolutely. I'll help you out.
Well, then I need that article like yesterday.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Commitment. I got commitment.
Yep.
Now, because I've been looking for you, okay? This is the whole thing. I'm glad Drew Phillips is the one that suggested that you come on, I imagine, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now let me tell you why this is important to the audience. Bitcoin has been around for a while. We've been paying attention. We understand the concept. If you have a bank or banks or individuals that can transfer wealth digitally, ones and zeros, over the internet, and it have value to send to someone that they're willing to send you stuff in order for the value sent to you in little ones and zeros, well, then all of a sudden you got yourself a currency. If you can do it anonymously, if you can do it without limit, if you can do it without the knowledge of anybody else, if you can do it, oh, you so freaking win. Now, this has come to the attention of Schumer out there saying, actually said the words Bitcoin. And you go, ooh, you done give him credibility. Heck, they could be a CIA psyop for all we know now if he's in it. So I'm just going, look, you know, that's another thing I didn't even thought about. You know, could this even be from the beginning? Do we know the source of it at the very base of this, that it's not a CIA project to get us on to blah, blah, blah? You see my point? So I'm just looking at, you know, what? I need to understand this because that's how we got into Federal Reserve problem to begin with. Us laymen
Is that your concern? Is that your concern that it might be a CIA project?
No, not really. But, I mean, you know, the point is that we got into the exact same situation that we are now with the Federal Reserve because we didn't understand what we were in. So I need
Let me lay that fear to rest. Yeah. So I'm not a programmer, but the Bitcoin code, the software itself that runs the whole network, is all open source. So say the CIA did make it. People can look at it and see exactly what it does, how it was built, how it operates. Every rule that it uses is all in the code. So anyone who's listening who understands the world of programming to understand that if it's open source software, you can trust it to the extent that you can read it. So that should
Okay, now let's go to the next. We'll get into some of the details. You're the guy to ask. I'm piquing everybody's interest here in a couple of minutes we got in this first segment. No, so let's go ahead and go this way. The other thing to be concerned about is the security of it. If you're transferring value from one place to another, one, you want to make sure it gets there, and two, you want to make sure that you can use it once you got it, and three, somebody can't just come take it. So all these traits of this currency have addressed that, I am sure. Walk us through it.
Okay, so whereas a normal transaction over the internet will use a central server, like when you send something with PayPal, PayPal systems are making sure that that transaction goes through and that your account is debited and the receiver's account is credited. So you have to trust PayPal in that case. With Bitcoin, there's no central party, which is the brilliance of it. So the question is, how is it secure and how can it be safe? And the way it's secure is that it uses advanced cryptography, basically principles of mathematics. And it uses cryptography that's more advanced than what bank sites use and all that kind of stuff. So to get into cryptography is pretty far beyond the scope of the interview, I think. But that's how you can trust it, math.
Okay.
Instead of trusting people or corporations, you trust math.
So let's put it this way. I could either trust the Federal Reserve and Bernanke and the U.S. government that they got my interest at heart and pinky swear, or I can trust ones and zeros encrypted Uber geeks out there that are keeping an eyeball on each other.
Correct. Yeah, you can trust the Federal Reserve or you can trust the laws of mathematics and open source software. You know, every time you buy something, you're trusting one or the other.
Okay, no, I'm hip. You know, I'm just, because in the end, either I know how to do it myself or I'm trusting somebody. I'll give you an example. I have a gentleman, I think his name is Michael Rupert. He comes up and he's doing his book, big deal about peak oil. Peak oil, we're going to run out of oil, it's all oil. I go, okay. And pre-interviews, talking to him, first thing I ask, I go, all right, how do you know? Well, the Saudi Arabian government told me. I go, seriously, that's your source? You know, I go, I thought you had a 2 mile long dipstick or something. I mean, you know, I need to know that you know. So you know, so let's say you're not the guy that knows, but you understand the concept of this. But we are putting faith in the community of open source, which we do know a lot of these guys. They can go in. I know personally some Uber geeks, and they go, oh, yeah, this is good, good. All right, fine. So let's put that aside and say, yes, we can transfer ones and zeros. We can do it securely. It can come into your wallet or whatever you got someplace on your hard drive. I got my Bitcoin is mine. and then we can spend those. Okay, so let's assume that we have, you know, gone through that process. Yes, it can be done to the point that the government is actually mentioning you and going, "You'd be a threat. You're a threat to whom for what?"
Yep. So,
well, who are you a threat to? Why are you a threat?
Well, there are a lot of layers of who Bitcoin might be a threat to. The first one would be other payment providers, so things like PayPal, Western Union. They make, you know, billions of dollars a year transferring what is already digital money. There's nothing physical about normal dollars. They're just transferring ones and zeros as well, but they make, you know, a boatload of funds. Bitcoin does the same thing without charging fees. So to the extent that it catches on is the extent to which their business model will be challenged. So those are the first people who need to feel threatened.
Okay, so we have the people that do the credit card companies, PayPal, different transfer. What is the charge that you guys, I guess there is no charge because you're using other people's computers and servers to power the yada yada. You know, give me how it is that Bitcoin has the ability to function without getting their cut, or do they get a cut?
Well, okay, so when you send an email, how much do you pay to send that email?
Well, some people would say nothing, but I'm paying an ISP.
Correct. So you're paying something that's extremely small, and in Bitcoin, basically you can opt to pay a very tiny fee to have your transaction process more quickly. Otherwise, pay no fee at all, and it'll go through quickly.
Okay,
as well.
So we got everybody's appetite whetted. We're getting ready to get into it. You know, your son, you know, he's the guy. We'll give you a little bio and history on her in just a little bit.
Arizona has been one of the hottest real estate markets in the past, up until the last couple of years. Homes that were once going for $500,000 to $1 million in prestigious areas are now going for less than half of what the original purchase price was. That makes it a very good time to buy. So if you were ever thinking of retiring to Arizona's inviting climate and laid-back and friendly lifestyle, now is the time. That's where I can help. This is Donna Hancock with Brangus Realty, and I have provided a way for you to search for properties that are of interest to you, all at your own convenience and without having to give out any personal information. Visit my webpage at DonnaHancock.com to start your search today. And when you're ready to make a move to Arizona's warm and sunny climate, please feel free to call or text me at 602-828-1819. Many are working hard to make sure Arizona is not only a beautiful place to live, but a free and peaceful one as well. So what are you waiting for? Make your move today by calling 602-828-1819. 1819, and don't forget to visit my webpage at DonnaHancock.com.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800, 602-264-2800, and now, Ernest Hancock.
I'm really excited. Eric Voorhees has promised he's going to write us something for this month's magazine. I know last month we did a whole bunch on, you know, all of this stuff, and even had some stuff on Bitcoin, and we've covered it on Freedom's Phoenix Talk. But I need someone that, you know, can kind of, you know, I never get enough. I want more. Because what I'm looking for is the article, okay? You want to know about Bitcoin? You go to this month's e-zine on Freedom Phoenix, and they put it up, and you subscribe, go and get that. That's the information you want to know. Boom shakalaka. That is the article. Eric's going to help us out. So go now. Eric is from Dubai. Now, how the heck did he wind up going to the Free State Project and then getting involved in Bitcoin from Dubai? You know, he writes, he's an entrepreneur, he's an armchair quarterback. He moved from Dubai to join the Free State Project in New Hampshire in order to advance the cause of liberty. And then he discovers Bitcoin, and he went down the rabbit hole. And he said, you know what? Here I be. Now, let me go ahead and ask you, Eric, you know, how do you – I got so many questions. One, why were you in Dubai? Two, how is it that you wound up going to New Hampshire? Three, when you found Bitcoin, did you understand what you were looking at? You just kind of get the concept? Are you a computer geek? I mean, help me out here. So let's start off with Dubai. What the heck are you doing in Dubai?
Yeah, so I'm not originally from Dubai. I'm from Colorado, but I moved to Dubai right after college, basically because they have no taxation of any kind, and that really appealed to me, as I'm sure it appealed to many of your audience. So I decided, you know, after school would be a great time to move across the world and have a little adventure, so that's where I went. And I was out there for a couple years, and I've been a signer of the Free State Project for probably...
Okay, whoa, time out. You went to Dubai to do what? Sit on the beach?
No, I went to go get a job. You know, after school, when there's no work, you know, around the U.S., it's a good time to leave. And so I just went over there and figured I'd find a job when I got there.
What would you find?
I worked for a real estate company. Yeah, I did marketing for a real estate company over there. You've probably heard they had a lot of real estate, so I was.
Well, what was your degree in? I mean, did you graduate? Did you have a little piece of paper said I can do this or what?
Yeah, I got a little piece of paper. It was for business leadership and international economics. Neither of which I learned very well in school at all, and much more of which I've learned since.
Oh yeah, you go to Dubai, you're going to learn about international finance, real estate, combined, you know, that to beat the crap out of your paper. Okay, so you go there, and you decided, you know, it's time to leave. Why? The economic boost bust started hitting there, or what?
Well, I'd been there for 2 years, and I had been a signer of the Free State for like 5 or 6 years. So I knew I was going to be moving to New Hampshire at some point. I was with a girlfriend over there, and she wasn't really digging it, so I just kind of made the decision. 2 years after I was there to come back and get settled in New Hampshire.
All right, cool. So tell us about that move. You're going, all right, you know, so here I come. Did you tell anybody? You just showed up at the doorstep. You started looking for when. What was your impression when you got there? How are you living? Do you have a job? Tell me everything.
You mean here in New Hampshire?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just moved on over. you know, one thing about living abroad is that whenever you move around here in the U.S., it doesn't seem like you're going very far, so it didn't seem like a big deal to me to move to New Hampshire, and I was obviously greeted by a bunch of wonderful people who showed up at like 9 p.m. in the evening in the snow to help me move all my furniture in, and we had some pizza and beer and made some friends quite quickly. So I'm still here. I live in Portsmouth.
Did you find your own home? You bunking with people? You in a tent in Lone Prairie? What?
No, I just rented an apartment for the first year, and then just recently moved into a shared house here down in downtown Portsmouth.
Okay, so now you're settled. You're sitting there. When did you move there?
I moved to New Hampshire originally in early 2011.
Okay, so you've been there about a year.
A little over a year.
Okay, yeah. So you get there, you start getting involved, and all of a sudden you're going, what? You know, why did Bitcoin get you all amped up? What happened? How do you
do it? I've never heard of it, and I see a post on Facebook about it, just some little quip. And so I was like, oh, I've never heard of that. And I started looking into it, and I'm a big metals guy, you know, silver and gold, and I love all that stuff. So money has always interested me. And when I started looking into it, my first reaction was highly skeptical. Basically, this looks pretty silly, like a big joke, or would never work, or must have tons of problems with it. And my skepticism faded in about an hour of heavy research, and I basically stayed up for 3 days and nights just looking into all this stuff. It got me totally hooked, and I went from skeptic to firm believer pretty quickly, actually.
So you got your own server bank in your basement mining bitcoins?
Yeah, I did for a while, but it put out so much heat that it was really becoming uncomfortable, so... There's not much money to be made in the actual mining itself unless you know what you're doing, but a lot of hobbyists like to do it. So, yeah, I dabbled in that a little. It was kind of fun.
Okay, so you're into it. What attracted you to it? What did you learn that convinced you this was the future? I mean, because we're all about the metal thing. I mean, you know we're the dime card, go kick ass, put some silver in somebody's hand guys, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I see the problems of the world and... And from my understanding of money and economics, I see them all kind of centralizing down on the currencies that people use. The ability of states to print money to fund everything, the inability of people to understand the tax of inflation, all that kind of thing. The ability to prevent a payment from one person to another just because the state doesn't want you to pay them. So when I learned about Bitcoin and realized that it can refute all these terrible powers, that's what really hooked me.
Okay, so now you have the ability to not only have value that you can transfer to someone else that can't be blocked and is not even known about by the man. So you're going, you know, that's good. I like that. You know, let's do that.
Yeah.
So your advocacy of this particular product is based on, you know, okay, the promise that it's making. Well, what about reality? Has it starting to take off? Is it working? Have you used it? How is it used now?
Well, it's worked perfectly since I heard about it. There hasn't been a single problem with the core protocol of sending and receiving money. That's extremely sound. And if that's ever shown to be unsound, then the thing could unravel quite quickly. So that's the big experiment, right, is if this code will hold up for the long term. So, but it works perfectly, and it's been really smooth. I mean, I send and receive payments all the time with it. I get paid. My salary is in Bitcoin. I send money to friends. I buy stuff online with it. You know, you can play poker. You can gamble. You can do all sorts of fun stuff. If you understand Forex and currency exchange, there are all sorts of exciting ways you can move money around the world instantly, arbitrage between different markets. So there's quite a bit to play with.
Now I got a Bitcoin round here next to my heart. I'm looking for it. Now, I have one that has an actual hologram on it, a little number, an actual Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And I'm going, so now why do I got a Bitcoin? You know, do I need this? What's the difference? What does it represent? We're going to find out when we come back with Eric Voorhees in just a little bit. You stay right there.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Hologram, you know, Alma had to call and tell me where she put it. You know, thank you, Alma. Okay, now Alma has some questions. She says, you got to talk about and make sure you ask them and whatever. And Alma, you do it. I have no idea what you're talking about. Go ahead and ask them.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you doing?
I believe I got a email from you about Paceus. It's a program that you can use to transfer any kind of purchases using Bitcoins, right?
Yeah.
Were you involved with the creation of that?
Yeah, that's a company my friend and I built. Basically, it's a merchant solution, so if you have a website and you want to take Bitcoin payments on your website, then you can use the system. It'll track everything and it'll convert it automatically to dollars for you.
Okay, now Alma has you know, an anarchist, you know, come do all your stuff here and we can transact and have businesses and we got, and I'm going to let her tell you about that Agoras Marketplace thing and, how she's hoping to integrate with exactly this using that she is your customer. This, you want to do this, you want to have it where it go on the website, you want people to be able to do transactions of goods and services between each other. Alma is the exact person that wants to make use of that. Here is your, this is what you created it for. So I'm going to go, okay, Alma, tell them what you're doing and how you want this to work and have you started yet?
Well, so far, the only thing I've accomplished with Bitcoins is mining them. So whenever, anytime anyone comes to my site, they automatically mine Bitcoins for me. I haven't created a wallet or anything like that for myself yet to store them and then use them to purchase, but I am looking into ways to purchase alternatively. So if there's software that I can get a plug-in for on my WordPress, for example, and plug it in, and now I can accept Bitcoins, or I can sell my products using Bitcoins, whichever, those services are, I mean, everyone's highly looking for those, I'm sure. But Agoras Marketplace is a place where any agorist can come and list their information on there for free. So if you have any kind of business where you accept alternative currencies, you are able to post your information on there and spread your message.
Agorist Marketplace. Thanks, Alma. Is there anything else? I want to get to Eric, and he can tell me everything about this. Is that what you need to know?
That's it.
All right. Thanks, baby.
Thanks.
Alma Summer here, Agorist Marketplace. Man, here we go. You know, this is exactly what you're talking about, Eric. This is what you set this up for. Now, here's someone saying, you know what? I'm mining Bitcoins already. I'm ready to start doing some transactions. Give me something I can plug into my WordPress, my website, my whatever, and let's make it go worse. Is that what you guys created?
Yeah, so I think she sort of had like two questions. One is how she can buy Bitcoins just straight up, and the other is how she can accept them as payment. So some people mine, but that's really kind of a distraction. It overly complicates things. Normal people should probably just focus on either buying Bitcoins with cash, or they should just sell things for Bitcoin.
So miners are abnormal people?
Yeah, I mean, well, look at gold and silver, right? We all use gold and silver as money, but how many of us are gold and silver miners?
We did! We went out in the desert a few weeks ago and got our own gold. Of course, it took 8 hours to get a tenth of an ounce, but we got it, okay?
So, yeah, I've waded through a river for 3 hours and didn't find anything. So.
Okay, so we have Bitcoins that are out there, and you don't want the mining to be easy anyway, but I mean, you know, there's a finite supply here, so you have created a currency that will only increase in value, certainly after they all get mined. So now you're wanting to have, here's somebody that's wanting to have the ability to do transactions in Bitcoins. Right now, I have the biggest, you know, aside from contributions and so on, we have subscriptions to our easing. So when we go, okay, we sell, I take Bitcoins. Where's my, you know, but I don't take Bitcoins now. How can I take Bitcoins? Give me something to take Bitcoins. How do I get Bitcoins?
Yeah, so to accept them as a merchant on your website, you would use a merchant solution. What she mentioned, Paytheus is one of my companies that works. There are others like BitPay. You can code your own if you know how to program things. But basically, those systems that you plug in, they plug into your website, and when a customer is going through the checkout process, instead of clicking on PayPal or instead of clicking on credit card, they would click on Bitcoin and then pay with that. And so it's all done within your site. All the orders are tracked and everything, so kind of an elegant solution.
Okay, now right now, Donna's sitting right over there ready to go put it on today's archive, a link to what you're talking about. What is she going to go look at to get this ability to put it up on our site to be able to take Bitcoin? I'm going to what?
Okay. Two companies I would recommend. One is mine, which is Paysius, PAYSIUS.com. The other is a competitor of ours, BitPay, BIT-PAY.com. They're also very good.
Okay, so I'm going to there and I say, ooh, I can take me some Bitcoin now. I go to my, you know, webmaster and I say, make this part of and plug it in. He charges me $1 trillion to touch code. So he goes in there and he puts it up there, and I'm going to benefit from this $1 trillion I'm paying my webmaster to put this up there because of what? How easy is it? It's just like clicking on an icon on PayPal and I go through it and all of a sudden now I got a bunch of Bitcoins?
Yeah, well, and basically you're allowing your people to pay with something that's not statist fiat currency.
So yeah, that's called silver.
Happiness right there.
It's called silver.
Are they going to send you silver instantly?
No, I'm hip. You know, it's got to be some kind of, you know, exchange. And that's one thing that I'm asking about Bitcoin. How is it valued compared to can I make a transaction? Because we have the Silver Calculator app, and they're starting to include Bitcoin on this thing. Well, how many Bitcoins equal an ounce of silver? I don't know. It's whatever somebody says it does. So how do we make that determination?
This is one thing that people have a hard time with, and they feel like Bitcoin is just a way to send normal money like dollars or something. But Bitcoin is actually its own currency. So just as the world has euros and dollars and yen, it also has Bitcoins now. So Bitcoins operate on a completely free market and have a floating exchange rate based on the bid and ask orders of other people who want to buy them. So just as you would go to buy euros at a foreign exchange place or maybe a kiosk at the airport, the same principle applies with Bitcoin. If you want to buy them, you go to an exchange and you trade your dollars for the Bitcoins, and there's always a current market price.
Okay.
Now the market price is about $4.90 per Bitcoin.
Okay, I go, Bitcoin equals silver. All right, buy a real silver coin with your Bitcoins. Okay. All right, let's go take a look. And they say gold is money, counting you on this, that, blah, blah. So there is various different places that the market has determined the value of a Bitcoin. So that market value right now in Federal Reserve, wish I was money, is about $4 and something. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
So that's like, so it's 1¾ dimes. 90% silver dimes. So that makes it about a tenth of an ounce, $4. Yeah, it's about a silver circle. One Bitcoin is worth a silver circle tenth ounce, approximately.
Yeah, roughly.
Okay, so I'm just like, I need to convert to silver, man. If I can't convert to silver, what good is it? So I'm going to, so we're going to go ahead and have Bitcoins in here, and I'm going to be trading sooner or later. I'm going to build me up a bunch of Bitcoins. I said, ooh, that's very nice for when I want to do some internet transaction, the man not knowing everything, but if I want to put it in my safe, give me some silver. But then I have an actual Bitcoin. Now tell me about the Bitcoin.
Yeah, so I'm glad you have one of those because those are always fun to talk about. So those are a physical coin with a special code that is sealed behind a hologram on the coin. And those are made by this guy over in Utah, I believe.
Oh, and everybody's on the edge of their seat. Got to wait till you come back. Eric, tell me about my coin. Right. I got my hand. Because I got it right here. Drew brought it back from Liberty Forum. And he said, here, Ernie, have it. And it's got a hologram that you can peel off. And I guess that voids it or gives, you know, you get the little number and you punch in. And, you know, where has this bill been? Kind of whatever the heck. We're going to find out when we get back with Eric. Eric Voorhees is going to explain it all to us. We'll be right back.
We know you're out there. We can feel you now. We know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. We don't know the future. We aren't here to tell you how this is going to end. We're here to tell you how it's going to begin. We're going back to editing the next edition of Freedom's Phoenix Digital Magazine now, where we are telling the people what you don't want them to know. We're showing them a world without you, a world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries, a world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice we leave to you. Subscribe at freedomsphoenixeasy.com. That's freedoms with an S, phoenixeasing.com.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
All right, guys, this is 50 10-ounce bars. Let's see if you can get down pretty much detail. 10-ounce, all right. 50 bars. Looking to trade some silver for bitcoins. Find me at 4bitcoin.com. No S, just 4bitcoin.com. Didn't have a black marker. Sorry, man. I had to use my kid's crayon. But that's how we roll, baby. That is me. I'm Chinese. Okay?
Okay, now those of you looking on the video feed, what you see is 4bitcoin.com. I just did a quick search. I put silver for Bitcoin. Bitcoin silver. What do I get? Boom, here's a YouTube from a guy showing all these bars of silver. And he says, look, here they are. Here's my driver's license. This is my picture from Tennessee. This is what I look like, and I'm willing to trade my silver for bitcoins. Okay. You know, there are other places to do that. Eric said, yeah, go check this site out and this site and that site, and good, there's people be a doing it. All right, what's the value? I don't know. Whatever you guys work out, it's not my problem. But the thing is that, you know, some people, I mean, that's what a transaction's supposed to be. I value your stuff, thing, whatever you got, more than my thing. And the person selling goes, you know what? I value your thing more than what I got. There is a transaction. Everybody walks away happy. And then the government wants to get in the middle of it and say, we get a cut. Why? Because we can. That's why. Damn it. We're gang with the flag and our little violin case here, and we say we get our cut. Oh. So what happens when you cut them out? They don't like it none too much. So here we go. Now, what's the other site that you suggested that we go to do silver exchange with bitcoins?
Yeah, I recommended coinable.com, but right now it looks like it's offline for me, which is strange. But it's basically a silver and gold bullion store.
Ooh, and they go offline, that'd be bad. Well, I got a coin able.
When I get on the radio.
I found a coin able. You know, it's a different, I don't know if it's the same one, but custom coins by coinable.com. That may not be it. It looks like it's a pin thing. But, you know, I'm interested in how we're going to be able to make the transition. So I'm going, yeah, I'm willing to do the transition, man. Let's make it go work. So what do we do? You say that there's some code, there's a widget, there's a something that I can put on my website, and I can start taking Bitcoins just like I take, you know, Visa, MasterCard, and Discover, and American Express, and I got PayPal, and all these up on my thing. I just add another icon, and you supply that, and where do I get it?
Yeah. So, yeah, Paysius, PAYSIUS.com is my company. We do that. And it's even better than that. So most companies are not going to be able to pay all their suppliers and their salaries in Bitcoin yet. So they need dollars. So basically what we allow is for someone to receive Bitcoin from anyone as payment, and then it's automatically converted at current exchange rates to dollars and deposited in their bank account. So it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Well, then what happens to the Bitcoin? You get it at a fee or something?
No, we when we accept it, it's sold on the market. So whoever has the highest bid order for that coin at that second, we'll get the Bitcoin, and we get their dollars, and then we give the dollars to you. So that's all done over the internet with the systems that we've all been building.
Oh, so my Bitcoin turns into tax.
That's right.
Yeah, so the man's making their cut already, you know? I'm like, all right, well, you know, if you're going to be using dollars, that's what happens. All right, now tell me about the actual coin that I'm holding here and the hologram on the back, and why did they make this coin, and was this expected or decided, or who? I mean, where did this come from?
Yeah, so that coin, I don't even know how to pronounce the name. It's like Cassius coin or something. But basically, it's a physical manifestation of a real Bitcoin. And so what it is it takes the private code that allows you to spend the Bitcoin, and it hides it behind a tamper-resistant hologram on the coin. So if you pass the coin around as money to your friends and back and forth, the value in it is stored behind the hologram in the code. Now, if you want to turn it back into a normal digital Bitcoin, you just destroy the hologram and redeem the code at a number of various websites, and then you get the Bitcoin back in normal form, but then the physical coin is destroyed.
Okay, how is it destroyed? I mean, when I go and I get it, because it has the hologram on it, it's not destroyed. When the hologram is gone, I know it's already been spent.
Basically, anyone who knows the secret code behind the hologram can spend that money. So if the hologram has been tampered with, you wouldn't want to accept that in trade because the money might already be spent and the coin might be worth it.
This number that I see in the hologram is not the secret number. I have to peel that off to get to the secret number?
Correct. The number you see is actually a way to check that the balance is still on the coin. So it's the first six or so digits of the code of the public address of this coin.
Okay, well, I haven't done that yet. Can I do that right now?
Yeah.
Okay, where do I go to do that? Where do I go? Come on, I want to do it.
Go to blockchain.info.
Okay, wait a minute. You cut out. Let me go ahead and do this on this computer. This is the one. Hopefully we'll get this in for the end of the show because I want to do this. This is Everybody follow this on. Here, we put it on here. Okay. Now, where am I going to go check this?
All right. Blockchain.info. B-L-O-C-K.
Block.
Chain.
Chain.
Yep.
Chain.info.
Yep.
Blockchain.info, go search for that. Comes up Bitcoin Block Explorer. Okay, I go in there, and now it's going to want me to, I don't know what the heck this is. Now, do I do a search on it?
Yeah, so you see where it says searched in the bottom right?
Yeah. Okay, bottom right.
Type in the code that you see on your coin into that search field, and then hit submit.
Okay, well, it says Bitcoin, doesn't say. There, I got search. You may enter a block height. Okay, so the first bit's in here. All right. So I go in and I put in.
It's case sensitive also.
All right, so I got to put caps on. Assuming I can read it. Y. 7. C. 8. VV. And does it happen the first time? Submit query! I go in there and it says address, blah, 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 hash, blah, 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 short link, blah, blah, blah. Okay, give me, it is number transactions right. One, unspent inputs one, total received one Bitcoin, final ballots, what Bitcoin? So it's so it's saying that I got a Bitcoin that's not spent and I can use it and it's a Bitcoin.
Correct. That means that thing's still valid and no one has screwed with your hologram.
Now, I get a QR code up here, too. Is that specific to this Bitcoin?
Yeah, that is specific to the public address on the front of the coin. So if you actually wanted to send more Bitcoins to that physical coin, you could do that with that QR code. So
this doesn't have to be worth only one Bitcoin. I can make it worth more. Take this coin, go on the internet, and that's a 50,000 Bitcoin.
Yeah, you could. I have a friend who has one of these. It's a one Bitcoin. He's put like 90 Bitcoins into it. So you can do that, but then it kind of screws up the face value of the coin. And then to take any of the coins back off, you have to ruin the label. So they're not really for that, but Bitcoin's pretty flexible. So
if
you want to send more
to have a car in Bitcoins on one coin, I have the option to do that.
Oh, yeah. And actually, you don't even need a coin. You can send $100,000 worth of Bitcoins in an email to someone in China instantly.
No, but I mean, the thing is that you don't have to mint different denominations of coins. You just do one. You can value it anything you want.
Yeah, correct.
Wow.
And the person taking it in physical trade has to be able to check it.
Okay. So, I can already see government done like this. Okay. This is bad. All right. This is bad.
Yeah.
So I got this up here. I can do that QR code right there. Goes to this Bitcoin. Where's my smartphone? Donna, hand me my phone. What I'm going to do. Thanks, baby. I'm gonna scan this up here and scan this actual QR code and go, okay, so what am I getting here? I hit the thing. This is freaking awesome. There it is.
Yeah, that'll give you an address that starts with the first six digits that were on your coin, if you'll notice. And that is the address to which you would pay money if you want to fund that coin more.
Wow. Okay, I'm starting to see. Now the government's going to be able... I don't even know what they're going to be able to do other than he had a Bitcoin on him, shoot him. I mean, what are they going
to
do?
They're still trying to figure that out.
What can they do?
What they can do is they can shut down public websites. If there's an exchange that they don't like, they can go to that exchange and they can shut that exchange down. This site, blockchain.info, is just someone's private site. They could go to him and turn his site off. But they can never stop the actual payment network. It's peer-to-peer.
Okay, so the threat would be I put this Bitcoin on. Oh, you're a Bitcoiner! You must therefore die, right?
Yeah. They can always shoot you, right, if they know who you are.
Well, that's the thing. I've been through this before. It's a libertarian thing is why we always say possession of anything is not a crime. Maybe evidence of a crime, but it's not a crime. Possession, and this is why. Because they'll go, you possess this. Well, who did I hurt? What did I do? You violated the law that we just passed, because we can. All right, I can see this is going to get ugly. We're looking forward to Eric Voorhees' article for this month's Easy. Right, Eric? Can I get an amen from you? Come on, say it.
Yep, you'll get it.
Good. We'll be right back. Stay right there, man.
Live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Today, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, from the beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. Everybody's saying, yeah, you say S after Freedoms. Okay, I got that part. How do you spell Phoenix? Phoenix for those of you. Okay. FreedomsPhoenix.com. We got today's archive. You know, we have 2 great hours already, and the 3rd hour going to Jeff Neen, Convoy of Hope, that was featured yesterday in Texas Straight Talk episode number gazillion from Dr. Bron Paul. He's got up there. I know everybody's like, you don't call him congressman? I don't want to insult him. So we have Dr. Paul gets up there, and he says, hey, man, you want to see a private solution to a lot of these problems? I give you Convoy of Hope. Because, you know, he said, look, just because we don't want government to do something doesn't mean that doesn't need to be done, or there's other people out there doing it. And oftentimes you got the man in the way of people doing it. I give you Katrina. You got 600 bass boats coming. We're going to go save the people. And there's an M16, you know, with a shiny badge behind it saying, no, you're not. I'm like, seriously? Well, here you have an example out of Springfield, Missouri, to where you have a couple of brothers that said, you know what? We were helped when we needed it. And there's been plenty of times a lot of us have. I personally, you know, I remember in 94, I was burned badly for, it was a lot of recovery, and everybody came together and made sure my family was okay. Very appreciated. And it's had a big impact on me wanting to serve others that are in need also. But you got to get the man out of the way. Well, here's Jeff Neen. He's going to tell us all about Convoy of Hope. Jeff, welcome to the show. Help me out. How did you come to the attention of Dr. Paul that he was so enthusiastic in his advocacy of what you're doing?
Well, the short version of the story, first, thank you for having me on, but the short version of the story is we heard that he was coming to Springfield for a political appearance, and Convoy is a very apolitical organization. We try hard as an organization to stay out of the political arena, although personally a lot of us have our own, you know, strong convictions. But we've tried to really embrace our mission with people of all political persuasions. So we heard he was coming, and so we thought, let's invite him to come by and tour and see the facility, because we know what we're doing matches his message so well. So, and he graciously came, and it was interesting when he came. It was a treat to get the chance to meet him and talk with him and show him around.
Had a big convoy of Secret Service, did he?
No, he did not.
Oh.
it was a relatively small group, but very, very informed, and asked a lot of great questions. It was a short notice thing, so he hadn't had a lot of time to do research on us, other than to know we were legitimate. You know, they checked us out a little bit coming in, but when he came here, he thought we would be much smaller than what we were, and that his first words out of his mouth were, "I'm very surprised at the size of your facility."
Well, how big is it?
We have a 300,000 square foot warehouse.
To give your
listeners a picture of that, if you put 6 football fields in a square or a rectangle, that's about the size of this building, and most of it is actually warehouse or distribution center.
Well, how many truck bays do you have? You know, like 18-wheelers backing up too. How many bays do you have?
Well, we have a lot more than we need. This is formerly a grocery store warehouse. So I think there's 40-some truck bays. We don't use them all, but they're all available, and we use quite a few.
Is all your space filled up? I mean, do you have increased capacity at that location, or do you need another one?
We have increased capacity, but we've been very, very fortunate through the years. We have leased out the space we don't need, so the building's always full. Right now, we're occupying approximately half of it, and there are times now, like after the Joplin tornado or during that response, where we rented tractor trailers and parked them in the parking lot where we were storing supplies.
Wow!
Because
you have facilities around the world? I mean, it's not just there, is it?
That's true. This is our main distribution point, and then we have 6 different small, you know, in some cases very small warehouses in 6 different countries around the world where we operate feeding programs.
Okay, now this is I wouldn't say faith-based. I mean, you're still you know, counting on, you know, like real money. But I mean, you know, this is a mission. Now the people are doing it out of, you recruit from the churches. Is this a particular faith? Is it Christian? You got, you know, like your Muslim wing. I mean, you know, how does this work?
it's the founders, you mentioned in your introduction, Hal Donaldson is our president and founder, grew up in a Christian home. His father was the pastor of a local church. At 12 years old, was killed by a drunk driver. His mom was severely injured, and that was really the beginning of Convoy of Hope. He and his brothers instilled in them. They went from being, you know, comfortable to being on welfare and taken care of by the generosity of others. And they purposed in their hearts that they wanted to give back. When we say faith-based, We look at that as we operate on Christian values and biblical values, but it's our faith that compels us to do what we do. It doesn't determine who we help, I guess would be a good way of saying it. We've been in, after the tsunami in Southeast Asia, I spent a little bit of time in Indonesia, very, very heavy Muslim area in the Aceh province where, for example, Christians normally wouldn't even be allowed, especially white Christians. But they were very gracious in allowing us to come in and help. They were very friendly, wonderful people. We had, you know, just a great experience. I've got great memories of that trip. But
do you have somebody comes up and says, "I want to help," and I'm dressed funny and Islamic, and I want to be on the board of directors? No. I mean, you know, what is the limitation of those that make up the structure?
The structure is determined, I think, probably first and foremost by a desire to help the poor and suffering. Secondly would be we want to remain at our roots a Christian organization in the way we function, again. But I just want to be real clear that has no bearing on who we help.
I have complete understanding. I just want to make sure the audience knows what, you know, if they want to help and they want to participate, that they get, you know, the questions asked and answered on this show that I know that they're wanting to know. Because I give you a perfect example. Here in Arizona, they have a thing called School Choice Trust, and it was done by some very hardcore Quakers. You know, they're good friends of mine that since then the gentleman has passed away. He's very elderly. He was in his 80s, but we've known him for, you know, a couple of decades. And they were very adamant about helping poor children get a private education. But they were on their board and so on. They were very open. Religion did not play a part in it, even though most of the money went to private Christian schools. My four children went 6 years each to a private Christian school, and because of our participation in this and help and whatever, we was Pope. So I'm going, okay, I need to know where the line is, where they got atheist libertarians out there busting butt for this cause. You know, for yours, it'd be, no, we're going to try and keep it more of a faith-based, oriented Christian organization and take the best of what Christianity is and help our brother. And if you want to help, we can do that, but we're going to keep it that way. And we think by keeping it faith-based is the best way to do that. And you may be right. We're going to talk about that a little bit more and what the Convoy of Hope does and why Dr. Paul is so enthusiastic about them when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and my new best friend, Jeff Neame. We'll be right back.
This is Charles Goyette, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Dollar Meltdown, so you can learn how to protect yourself and your family. Now, you can audit the Fed. You can end the Fed. But why not start by ignoring the Fed? Visit DontTreadOnMeme.com. That's Don't Tread on MEME, Fashioning the Silver Economy. A meme, a contagious idea that spreads within a culture, a spontaneous order. Nowhere is this more evident than in one's free choice in that most marketable of commodities, money. Let us Austrians use wallet voting. Don't Tread on Meme, the leading craftsman of silver dime trading cards, as well as some offbeat liberty-themed apparel. Follow the history of the dime card outreach at onceuponadime.info and get a silver calculator app at whatisthiscoinworth.info. Boycott an empire of theft. Build a society of consent. Don't Tread on Meme.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800. 602-264-2800. And now, Ernest Hancock.
Make sure they got their props, saying, oh, these are the boys I've been talking about. And you multiply them times a gazillion, and there's a bunch of good people out there being good, want to do good. You know, and who's bad? The government's bad, you know, because they always use coercion and force to do, and they pinky swear. Whenever you see something like Convoy of Hope being successful, what they do, you go, we don't want you to be successful. We need to do it. You're doing it wrong. You're not allowed. We got a FEMA camp we need them to go to. So I'm like, you know, go to the stadium, man. Get your water. Well, here comes Convoy of Hope. I want to ask Jeff. Jeff Dean is here talking to us about the Convoy of Hope, and I'm wondering, what's your position? How is it that we're talking to you? You do what?
I'm really kind of the spokesperson for the organization.
Why? Because you got a pretty voice, or what?
I've got a great face for radio. That's what does it.
You win. Okay.
Yeah. My background's in media. I've worked in media for 30 years now, and really enjoy it. Love it. I love telling the stories of the people whose lives we've touched. So I guess I'm the natural fit for the job.
You know, and that would be, I know that we could take up the entire time of just all the people that have been helped. So when got a big giant warehouse like that, as goodies coming in and going out to somebody that needs them really bad after a whatever, I bet they'd be singing y'all praises. But I want to get in more in the mechanism that even allows that to happen.
Sure.
So when you have this facility here in the United States, is that your only facility, your main facility? How does that work?
That's our main facility here in the United States. We've looked at the possibility of doing regional distribution centers, but really aren't to the size where it makes economic sense yet. I think someday we will be at our growth rate.
When gasoline hits $8 a gallon, then you'll be all over.
Exactly. But we have six fairly small, most of them are small facilities in six different countries around the world where we have children's feeding programs that are ongoing. We feed about 115,000 children on a regular basis. Many of those are either every day or every school day.
Okay, where do you get your resources? People are donating their time, their money, their goodies. It comes from corporations. Are they, you know, we're near the expiration on here. Somebody will want this. I mean, is it all, we're exporting our packaged, processed, blah, 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 or is it actual real staples? I mean, give me a snapshot of what you're doing.
Yes to almost all of that. People give their we operate purely on a donation basis. We have people, churches, companies all across this country and literally around the world that send us cash gifts. We also have a ton of corporations that we work with, major corporations that provide food, water, cleaning supplies, different things like that we need in our work. So it's kind of a combination of everything the private sector has coming together to help people in need.
And this is based on what criteria that you would put the trucks in motion? I mean, you know, it's like little storm, big storm, you guys just sitting there watching the Weather Channel. I mean,
yeah,
how do you do this?
It's a great question. I'll back up one step from that. We basically have a driving passion to feed the world, and we do that in four ways. We do it through children's feeding initiatives, community outreach events, disaster response, and then the fourth one's what we call partner resourcing. So it depends on the situation. We identify groups of children that we can feed usually through schools or orphanages in our children's feeding program. Community outreaches take place primarily in this country. In fact, we are just kicking off next month in Dallas a 50-state tour called the Convoy of Hope, which we are going to send our trucks and our outreach events, which are these huge one-day events in a community designed to help people in poverty. We're going to be hitting all 50 states in a 24-month period with those events. And then disaster response is a third one. We mentioned Joplin. We were very active in Katrina. We were in Japan after the big earthquake and tsunami there last year. So the criteria are different for each one. For disasters, we base it on it's kind of an informal formula on how many people are affected, how long the situation is supposed to last, and what local resources are doing. Do they have enough local resources to take care of the need, or do they need outside help?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's can we get there fast enough so they don't die? Okay, so
right.
That's the next question. You know, let's say all of a sudden something bad happens, and I'm here in Phoenix, and the comet hit and laid waste to whatever, and I'm like, Convoy of Hope, come hit me. You know, how much can you bring to bear, and how long would it take?
We could be there in whatever the driving time is. We can usually get our trucks loaded. It's interesting because different disasters are different. Hurricanes are actually the easiest disaster to prepare for because, give you an example with Katrina, we knew that one was coming. We actually had, it was either three or four trucks in Louisiana, northwest Louisiana, when the storm hit. When the storm made landfall, we were already staged. We knew the west side of the storm would be the least impactful. And so what we do is come in on the backside. As that hits land, it normally curves east, and we come in on the west side and circle in behind it. We were literally following state police cars down I-10, and they had trucks with them that were clearing debris and trees and everything like that, and we're kind of inching along as part of that convoy.
Okay, now right there sounds like a little cooperation with the man. Are they you calling the local chief of police and saying, hey, we got trucks to help, and they go, okay, until you get the FEMA involved, and they go, no.
We actually work well with FEMA. It's been a learning process for us, but it's developed into a decent partnership. But what we do is we try to do it from a coordination standpoint. And I'll give you another great example. We went into a disaster one time doing our own thing and ended up setting up right across the street from a FEMA distribution point. So it was kind of like a waste of resources. So what we've done since then is we've tried to coordinate very closely with not just the federal emergency management folks, but also state and local, and do it from a coordination standpoint. We're here to help. Where can we fit in? What niche can we fill so we're not duplicating effort and duplicating resources?
Oh, heck, I'd just do it and say, you guys fill in, you know?
Yeah.
So, shut up. So you guys go in, you're there first, you're sitting on the corner, and then FEMA opens up across the street. I mean, who's there first?
It depends on how you ask the question, because they have their plans in place. We have our plans in place. So it's really not as much a question of who got there first.
Is Convoy of Hope turning people away that want to help? I don't think so. Well,
no.
That's the difference right there. When we come back, I want to go ahead and talk about this convoy and when they come into Phoenix and what can we do to amp it up just a little bit, because we can.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't.
So good! So good! Yeah! We got good reason, too. Jeff Nene from Convoy of Hope. Now, they're doing an actual convoy. You know, Convoy Breaker 19. We're going to be going around the country with them. We'll follow it. We'll put it up on Freedom's Phoenix. We'll get Donna's already way ahead of me, man. She's already all over this, got something in it, promoting it in the magazine. But I guarantee she didn't have the right page that had the tour dates and so on. So we're going to make sure that Jeff Nene from Convoy of Hope gets us a little something, something. Can I get you to give me a little article, a little something, send me something? We can put it in there, make sure everybody knows what's coming.
Absolutely. We'll be glad to. Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, yeah. We get, you know, we get all the boys, you know, writing on, yep, we want to help. Because you don't have, if I go to, in the press kit on this, they'll have, you know, starting to promote it. It's not on Convoy of Hope's regular website. It's on Demos News. Now, you go to demossnews.com/Convoy of Hope, but it doesn't matter. You go to today's archive, and we have the link up there. Right, Donna? For the Convoy of Hope tour thing up here. Yeah. Done. So you go to the today's date, and you just go to today's archive for the show, April 10th, and you'll see in the show notes and everything all the links to this, because they're starting a tour this May, and it's going around the country, and they're going to be promoting what they do, 50 states. Now, they don't have Arizona yet, so that means, you know, whenever they do, we're going to hit. We're going to make a big stinking freaking deal out of this, because the whole point is, will the people take care of their brother, sister, mom, dad, children? Yes, they will. Get out of the way and let Convoy of Hope be an example. Now, let's go ahead and talk about, are there, you've kind of had a good reputation dealing with the government, and you're just kind of like not wanting to duplicate efforts and so on, so you need to coordinate with them a little bit. It's like, hey, can we have more than one place to go get water and food? So you're filling in some gaps. You're, you know, smart enough not to be waiting until 3 weeks after for FEMA to come. You're actually falling behind the storm. You know what? When you have big, giant hurricanes, guess what? You got people need some goodies. So you're falling back, and there you are. So give me the kind of help that, I mean, are you bringing in, what, just food and water? Or you got generators? Or you, I mean, what's the limitation on the kind of help that you give?
What we've done in disaster situations is try to find what we can do well and concentrate on that. And what we do the best, we've found, is food, water, and some supplies. Like after flooding, we'll do cleaning supplies and bleach and things like that that people are going to need to help clean up. We also bring in teams where this is something that's been tough for us to really do efficiently, but we're finally starting to get a handle on it, and we're going to start focusing more. We'll bring in debris removal teams after tornadoes or hurricanes, floods, mud out people's homes, different things like that. After Joplin, we were able to really develop, I think, better our response in that manner. So we've got a fully equipped debris removal trailer now that we can bring in after a storm. We've got teams that we're starting to do better at getting teams in place to bring in volunteer teams. And we really use local people as much as we can. We partner closely with churches in different communities. Not only do they support us financially, but they support us with volunteer labor. And in the aftermath of a storm or a tornado or a hurricane, something like that, that's just as valuable as the cash. You need the cash in order to get the product you need and pay your diesel fuel bill and things like that. But you also need that volunteer help to.
Yeah, you need a flash mob. You get on the Twitter, they get on, you know, the text messaging, the email. It's like, you know, boom, shakalaka, flash mob over here, help do what. Yep. And if you got the coordination and what you need exactly done, it's like, hey, man, bring the shovel and rake, you know. Yep. And we're going to go and clear and do it. I understand. And that is what the biggest. I tell you, I went through this in the 90s. There was, you know, during all this militia craze and so on in the 90s, there were a lot of people that, you know, why would they organize, you know, and oh, my goodness, they have a gun. Well, they were doing exactly this. There was a lot of floods and so on. So they have just, they didn't know how else to organize. They just go, yeah, you know, we're just a bunch of gun enthusiasts. I knew a lot of these people. There was no problem. They didn't, they're just like, yeah, we're here, you know, committee of, we're going to help you. So they come in and they go, oh, but you got guns. You're not allowed. And they're going, you know, seriously? So I'm looking for what kind of infrastructure and people you're willing to take help from. So I would imagine, you know, the church has got their own groups. They got, you know, a lot of people that want to just help. A bunch of them damn libertarians, you know, out there just wanting to prove a point that they can be of assistance. You got the Love-Olution out there, supporters of Dr. Paul. You got freedom brings people together. And if you have someone like you that Dr. Paul has endorsed your efforts and wants to bring and highlight this, why, guarantee when you come to Arizona, we'll put on the show.
All right.
So that's, we show putter honors, okay? So
good.
You let us know. We'll go ahead and we'll demonstrate what we can do for you a little bit here just by bringing attention. Dr. Paul, you picked the right guy. So, but that, you know, that's another thing. I mean, do you have the other campaigns go, hey, man, we want to come too? Or you have this, I've seen this invade. Before we get to this break, I want to bring this up. There was, with the Bush administration, they came in with this faith-based initiative, government money, we do kind of, and the bottom line came down to, yeah, and we get your church's database, you know, and then it got into politics. And then here we go, churches become a special interest. Is that a threat to you guys? Are you guys on the radar screen? Are you taking faith-based initiative money? You know, how's that working?
We try, again, we're trying to coordinate with any government entities that are involved in the same things that we are. We had a good experience with the Bush administration in the fact that he shown exactly or very similar to what Dr. Paul is doing. He allowed his office to shine a spotlight on what we were doing in the aftermath of Katrina and as well the year before. There were four hurricanes that hit Florida back to back to back to back. And he came and visited one of our sites and brought a big media tour, you know, with anywhere.
Yeah,
the president
but did he bring
goes,
a checkbook
always.
From the government?
No, and that's okay because we're one of the things
no, that's
that
good.
We really focus on. Yeah, one of the things we focus on is, you know, again goes back to our faith-based organization. We want to connect people. We want to connect people that want to serve, people that want to help with people in need. And we're able to secure that funding through the private markets, really, through individuals, through the private sector.
Okay, just
businesses.
To be clear, I want to get an answer to the question.
Sure.
Are you part of the faith-based initiative? I get some kind of government money pipeline to control database sharing, kind of anything.
Not to that degree. We don't share our database. And to my knowledge, I can't say this unequivocally, but to my knowledge, we've never gotten money from faith-based initiative. We have received money from USAID. We have had a couple small grants along the way that have helped us in our children's feeding program and in other feeding initiatives in foreign countries.
Okay, tell me what USAID is before I freak out, you know.
I wish I could answer the question completely, but it's basically an arm of the government or a resource from the government that will provide funding or will provide food products in times of need. When we were in Haiti, for example, after the Haiti earthquake, there was a lot of USAID food, you know, branded food. It's, you know, the packaging has the USAID labels on it.
So the extra cheese they had in the warehouse kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know where that comes from or what it is.
No, the government buys it up from surplus to keep prices up from the people producing because they got a special interest kind of government. You know, it's always a government thing, man. Hey, you know, we're coming up on a break here real quick. When we come back, I want to go ahead and get into actually how people can be of assistance and help and keep you off of the man, you know? So because if we don't help, you know, that's where you open up the opportunity that we want to. There's people starving. There's people, you know, dying of cold and heat and hunger and dehydration. And when you get put up against that, well, then you're looking for help from anybody to save the children. You know who should be doing it? Us. And Dr. Paul is pointing out somebody deserving of our attention. Get more attention when we come back in just a little bit.
Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what the readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com get every day. FreedomsPhoenix.com, constantly providing the information, the real news about government policies, and the real relationship we all have with the coercive government. The real condition of the economy, innovations in technology, breakthroughs in energy, health, and computer science. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media. The corporate media, nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but now there's an alternative. freedomsphoenix.com. Constant news updates on the issues that affect your life in the most important ways. With liberty and property under constant attack, freedomsphoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda, and it encourages the participation of its readers. Go to freedomsphoenix.com. That's freedoms with an S, phoenix.com. freedomsphoenix.com. The revolution between the ears has already happened. Rhodes? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Okay, maybe a couple of roads, you know, so we can get the convoy there. But none of this. You know, I'm never advocating we're going to put a gun to your head, take your money, and build some roads. You know, they put it in the. You know, this is another thing. It's in the fuel tax. It goes up. They go. Oh, we're going to have to cut back on the roads. And, oh, we're going to have to charge you by the mile. We're going to charge you by the mile for the roads. I go, yeah, it's called gas. You know what I mean? Seriously, if they can get more, they want more. They're going to get some more for somebody, not me. You know, and if you want to keep the government out of your life, you got to provide for your brother's needs. Because I tell you, when somebody goes hungry, yeah, they get desperate. And desperation causes violence. And if you showed love in the revolution, you want to love your brother, you know, let me tell you how you do it. With love. Because you think love is like a noun. It's also, or more really, a verb. It's something you do. It's like in your relationships with your wife, your husband, your kid. If you don't, you know, think you love them enough, it's because you're not loving them enough. It's a verb. It's a thing that you do. If you don't feel, you know, warmth and love for your fellow man, it's because you're not loving them enough. And let me tell you who the people are helping love them. Convoy of Hope. And we're so glad Dr. Paul got a chance to. Who made the decision? Jeff Nene from Convoy of Hope. Who made the decision to contact Dr. Paul in the first place? How'd that happen?
Well, again, the short version of the story, there's a person that's working on Dr. Paul's staff. I'm not sure if it's campaign staff or congressional staff, that knew our founder from years ago. They've known each other for a long time, and he suggested it. So I extended the invitation through him. We extended a formal invitation, and he decided he wanted to come visit while he was here, and we were thrilled that he did.
Score. How much time did he spend with y'all?
Oh, he was here for probably about an hour, which was, you know, a surprise to us. We, you know, a lot of times when a candidate is coming through, it's a quick photo op and then they're off again. But Dr. Paul came and spent time and asked so many intelligent questions about what we were doing and really took a genuine interest. And we were thrilled.
Because you're
that.
An example of exactly what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is, you know, it's in his self-interest to promote what you're doing because this is what he's promoting. You know,
yes.
The other thing is, I mean, did he have 15 gazillion cameramen and press with him, did he?
It wasn't a real big turnout, no. He had a couple of his own camera people, and we had some local media people that came and covered the event. So it was a little bit of an entourage, but not like what you see in some cases.
Right, so he was there to actually go visit.
Yeah, for him, and they made no requirements on us at all. It wasn't, well, we'll come if you can get press coverage or that sort of thing. They just wanted to come and see what we were doing and what we were about.
I mean, is he totally different or what?
I really enjoyed getting the chance to meet him and interact with him on that level. It was a treat.
You know, by comparing Dr. Paul with the other politicians, you know, it's just not even in the same category. You know, these other guys are slime, kind of freaking, ew, I need to bathe. Well, Dr. Paul gave you some props. How's it worked out? You've been getting a lot of attention?
We really have. We've gotten a lot of media coverage as a result of it. In fact, just yesterday, I got a copy of the official congressional record for March 27th, where he went on the floor of the House and read a commendation to Convoy of Hope, and we got an official copy of that. We've gotten all sorts of inquiries from the media. It's been really a great experience.
Well, you know, I mean, you got to be careful because the media, you know, certainly from, you know, we support the government, they're looking for, ooh, Convoy of Hope is really a satanic pentagram worshiping goat sacrificing entity of the blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know.
Fortunately, we've never had that accusation.
Well, you know what I mean. I mean, they're looking for a chink in the armor. They're going, yeah, but they don't, whatever. Yeah, I mean, they'll start coming out there. Yeah, well, how many Muslims do they have on their board of directors? I mean, you know, it's just kind of crap. So I'm just, and if you can just rise above that and just keep doing what you're doing, and we want to help. Because the problem has always been is that, I give you an example. John Stossel does programs and various things, and one of them was about philanthropic efforts like yourself, that you're going out feeding the hungry, you're passing out this. Oh, I'm sorry, you're not doing it right. You had the wrong stuff. You didn't get a permit. You're not packaging it properly. You have to, you know, this person needs to go hungry because you didn't wrap it in a certain way. I mean, it's just this kind of stuff. And the reason they do, one, because they can, but it's just, yeah, you know, and I'm wondering how you protect yourself from that kind of intervention. I mean, what is protecting you? You just, are you following their rules? Are they presenting you with rules? Or are they just leaving you alone?
We've been really fortunate. For the most part, we've been left alone. We have not had a lot of government intervention in what we do. I think
them days is over.
Because we have, you know, over the past, we have a good track record of having a cooperative spirit and trying to work together from an organizational standpoint. Nobody has really, you know, there's always the little things from small splinter groups. But we've never had, fortunately, and we thank God for it, but we've never had, a real resistance to what we do, because by its very nature, it's a pure desire to help people in need.
And there are bad guys that do not want that example without a badge behind it or a uniform or a tax program. So I'm just going, when and if, well, really when, that happens, okay, please let us know. The Lovolution will be there to help y'all, because whenever you have a perfect example like this that would advocate for people taking care of themselves, there's always somebody that wants to bring you down or you know, sell your name, or they find the one truck driver that didn't, you know, they got a DUI or something. I mean, you know, it's just, I mean, it's always something. When this happens, please allow us to tell your story and to help. And you need to make use of the Lovolution alternative media here to fight back, because I've been through this so many times. I want to make ourselves available to you to help you, because I know that you're such a perfect example. It's when you have somebody that is successful in what you're doing that you'll have the detractors coming out when you're demonstrating how ineffective the government is at this stuff. So I'm going, you know, and I know your peace and working with and kind of and FEMA and your buddies and all that guys, but I mean, you know, it comes, FYI, we're here as a resource when you need us, okay?
Well, thank you so much for that offer. We greatly appreciate it.
Because you're going to need it. So this is, are there storms you're watching now? I mean, when is your busiest time? Is it, you know, kind of going in the sun? Is it hurricane season? Is it the winter storms? Is it, I mean, you know, when do you think your busiest time is?
Spring has a tendency to be a very busy time because there's, you know, the thunderstorms are more prevalent, especially in the Midwest. Flooding ends up coming as a result of that. And then hurricane season, you know, really runs from about now through September, October. It's a pretty good swath of the
summer. Real quick before we run out of time, Fukushima, you know, you're going into Japan. I mean, you're going to Indonesia. So, I mean, you got your own ship? Are you using UPS? I mean, how do you make this transition? Who's your forward team?
Most of what we do internationally, we use contract carriers. We use different shipping companies that will ship these big metal containers that you see. Occasionally, we will, in emergency situations, FedEx has been a great partner with us. When they have available space on flights into a country that's in need, they will allow us to put product on there and not charge us for that. So they've been very gracious to us. And we get different companies like that from time to time. We were able to get on a private air cargo company gave us 2 flights into Haiti. Immediately following that earthquake. So,
now, what if you got some, wealthy libertarian out there with his own, ship, jet, boat, something, and he says, "Hey, man, it's yours, man. What do you want to do? I mean, you got paperwork you got to go through?" Or he said, "Yes, and Bob, just put it in and let's go."
Very, very little on the paperwork. What we're very relationally driven. So what we will do is if somebody is out there that wants to do that, if they will contact us and talk to me, we'll get the process started. And basically, we just want to make sure that they're legit and that, you know, there's not an ulterior motive or a hidden agenda. And then we love working with businesses. We'll have some of our corporate relations guys that will work out the details with them and put that into action.
You know, it might be, you know, if you could make available how it would benefit them tax-wise, like, you know what? I'd be all kind of philanthropic and I get to write it off, you know?
That's right.
It's all good, all good, all good. Because you guys are 501c3, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, you're a little bit of government
gift
there.
Is tax-deductible.
Yeah, you know, whatever. But, you know, there's some benefit. Right on. Hey, thanks for Jeff Nene from convoyofhope.com. And they got a tour coming. We're gonna make sure we get on it. Thanks for spending time with us, Jeff. It was
a
pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Hold on just a moment. We'll be right back tomorrow. And then, no. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we're going to take some time off. I got a bunch of projects going. We're going to have the best of some reruns over the last month. They're going to be good.